Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of Deckert LLP and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. There's a border battle for the Bears. The Chicago Bears are looking to build a new stadium. First, they were looking at Arlington Heights, then back to Chicago, then back to Indiana, and then Arlington Heights. It's very confusing. Well, nobody knows where we're at this point. Indiana's put together a tax and property package that's been getting a lot of media buzz. But Illinois lawmakers are working on their own package. So let's bring in State Rep Cam Buckner, who's leading the charge on the package. Thanks so much for joining us once again on Legal Face-Off.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. Representative, so this bill that you're sponsoring, you've called it a mega projects bill, not a Bears bill. But listen, obviously, that's on top of mind. That's what's driving this legislation. Talk to us a little bit more about the bill, what you're trying to accomplish, and whether it's realistic that there's enough time to get this passed and keep the Bears, given how aggressive Indiana's been.
Yeah, the bill that I presented and passed through committee last Thursday is a bill that is focused on a mega project pilot, right? Payment in lieu of taxes, which some folks have called property tax certainty. But it really gives private companies the right and the ability to negotiate with municipalities about property taxes for the 20 to 40 year period. And you know, the problem that it solves really for me is bigger than football, because in Illinois we're great at building things, we're just not always great at getting out of our own way to build them, right? So right now, if you're trying to land a true mega project in Illinois, you're not just competing with other states on incentives, you're competing on certainty, on speed, on clarity. All right, so the idea behind this is to make sure that we can speed up these processes now. I've called it a mega project bill because that's exactly what it is, and it would be a statewide tool. But obviously, you can't forget the elephant in the room, that the Bears are looking at this as the tool that they need in order to move forward. And so we've had a lot of conversations with the Bears over the last couple of weeks and months. They've been fruitful, and I think we're moving in the right direction. I know that Indiana hangs in the balance, but frankly, as I've said publicly, and I'll say it again here, I don't feel pressured by Indiana. I think the Bears can see the writing on the wall. I think they see that the best deal for them here is here on this side of the state line.
Listen, from a fan's perspective, like, all that is interesting, and you know, it's a little bit like inside baseball, to be honest. For most of our listeners and viewers, what they care about is having the Bears in Chicago, even though, or at least in Illinois, right? Even though, you know, it might be actually faster to get to Hammonds than, or Gary, than Arlington Heights, sometimes even to get to, you know, Soldier Field, where it presently is. But at the end of the day, like, why is this taking so damn long? This has been a conversation for years. And, you know, like someone who's cramming for a final exam, why is this all happening at the last minute, especially considering how quickly and aggressively your counterparts in Indiana have moved?
Well, let me first say, I'm going to push back on that. The Bears bought the land in Arlington Heights since 2023. We are now in the early months of 2026. To put that in context for you all, Barclays Arena, where the Brooklyn Nets play their basketball in the city of New York, it took 12 years to get to that deal, to get that deal to completion. When you look at U.S. Bank Stadium in Minnesota, where things were a lot easier, you know, based on the politics there, that took about 5.5 years. When you look at Allegiant Stadium in Nevada, where everybody was on the same page for the most part, that took 4.5 years to get a shovel in the ground, right? And so when people say, why is this taking so long, it just shows our attention spans are very short, and that we're not paying attention to how complex stadium deals are and how long it takes to get there. But with that being said, what we saw in Indiana was folks moving at breakneck speed to quote-unquote get something done, but not necessarily to get it right, because what we see now is that people in Indiana are clamoring because they are finally realizing that you don't get a NFL football team for free without putting $1 billion worth of more taxes on the people who live there. And so when you see the engagements now in the state of Indiana, reminding folks about this smorgasbord of taxes that are at their doorstep now, there's a lot of pushback there. And so that is not a done deal. It was great flash. It made a lot of sense for the headlines. But when you get down to the meat of it, there is no there. And so we're doing the right thing. The Bears have an obligation to do what's right for their bottom line. And those of us in state government have a right and an obligation to do what's right for the people of this state. And that means going through this with a fine-tooth comb and making sure it makes sense.
So, Representative, you raised an excellent point, the tax burden, right? And ultimately, this deal is stuck in the mud for many, you know, from many people's perspective because of the basic question of who pays for it, right? Does a private company who is owned by a family, are they responsible, who get all the income, are they responsible for funding a new stadium, or should the taxpayers pay for it? That's ultimately the question, and not just this deal, but all of these deals. And, you know, our governor has been very vocal in saying that he won't allow the taxpayers to bear that burden. He will, you know, lead a fight, as you have, for paying for infrastructure. Many people don't see much difference in the two, but explain to us ultimately, you know, why the taxpayers should be responsible for any of this.
Well, listen, I've been a huge proponent of making sure the taxpayers are not on the hook for these stadium deals, because the truth of the matter is that, you know, you hear folks talk about how lucrative these things are for cities and states, but it's just not true. Stadium deals are not magic beans, right? A stadium by itself does not automatically create regional prosperity. If it did, every city with a stadium would be booming and nobody would be arguing about teacher pensions, right? What stadium deals do create reliably is a temptation. It's the temptation to confuse activity with growth, and we have to have that conversation. The Bears are doing, you know, what every modern NFL team has done, because the modern NFL model, and frankly, the modern pro sports model more broadly, incentivizes owners who do two things at once. One, maximize private upside, right? Premium seats, suites, naming rights, sponsorship integrations, year-round programming, concerts, adjacent real estate, and also externalize the public cost of that, right? So that means roads, bridges, transit access, traffic control, policing, and in some cases, it means that the actual building of a stadium. You know, I'm not saying that every single stadium deal is a scam. I'm saying that the incentives are designed so that the first question in the owner's boardroom has to be, how much of this can we get the public to carry? And I think that that's backwards. I think that's wrong. And so part of the reason that we've been very intentional here in Illinois is that we've got the opportunity not just to shift the paradigm on how we deal with stadium deals here, but how people look at these deals around the country. The rest of the country is watching us, and we have to get this right.
So with this deal, then, I know you're a big proponent of the Bears staying in Chicago. I mean, would this package put Chicago back in play in your book? And what is the problem with the Michael Reese property?
Well, listen, I've been huge on that. I don't think that there's anything wrong with the Michael Reese property. I think it is a fantastic piece of land, lakefront adjacent. It does, to me, all the things that the Bears would need in this space. But for some reason, they have not been willing to have that conversation. You know, I would hope that as we continue through these negotiations, that the city of Chicago, that the mayor, folks in the city council, developers in Chicago are willing and ready and even primed to have these conversations with the organization about why Michael Reese makes sense. You know, the truth of the matter is this, and we've talked a lot about leverage in these conversations, you know, Indiana versus Illinois and Arlington Heights versus Chicago. I think first, you know, leverage kind of makes it sound like this is a hostage negotiation. And I've said very clearly, this is not. A private company can always move. They always have the ability to go where they want to go. You know, but we got to throw it all on the table here, right? Chicago is a flagship market. We're not pretty good. We're not just up and coming. We are a flagship market, which means that the brand value is higher here. It means that the sponsorship value is higher here. It means that media value is higher here. That premium inventory is easier to sell, that corporate partnerships are deeper here, that the franchise valuation actually is stronger here than it is anywhere else that the Bears are looking at, right? And so, you know, I think that we should have a conversation about what that looks like, about what their footprint in Chicago is. And just to be clear, a lot of folks bring up the New York Jets, New York Giants model. This is not the same as two teams in the New York Metro doing a long-standing shared arrangement at MetLife Stadium. That's an established metro footprint. that's been normalized for decades, right? This is something different that's being threatened here. And so I think that the Bears are finally looking at the math and realizing that it makes more sense definitely to be on this side of the state line. And I frankly think it makes more sense to be in the city of Chicago. We'll see if they get there.
Representative, you ran for mayor of Chicago back in 2023, the next mayor elections in 2027. If the Bears move, or it's announced that they move, at least they won't be moving before the end of this mayor's term. But if this deal is lost under the current mayor term, do you think that provides a platform for you should you choose to run again for the mayoralty of Chicago?
What a loaded question. There's a lot of reasons to consider running for mayor of Chicago. I wouldn't put this in the top five, right? When you look at the issues with pension and the fact that we just, tanked our credit rating a little bit more, and we got issues when it comes to our schools and finding ways to fix public safety. And we did a great job, I think, in Springfield on public transit, but it still has a lot of work to do. I don't think that falls in the top five category, but people care about this, man. People are emotional when it comes to their football team. Chicago and the Bears are synonymous, and I think you can't separate them. And so people feel this in a different way. I think that there is an opportunity for folks for the Bears to once again get what they want and for taxpayers not to be left on the hook. And I'm sure it will be a part of the next mayoral conversation. I just am not sure who will all be in that conversation.
Nothing to announce today. Last question, at least that I have for you, Representative, is you're a former football player. You played at University of Illinois. We're very excited by the way the season ended, kind of a rough ending, of course, but great season. How do you foresee the team looking next year, even though we just lost the best center in football analysis retiring after, only a few years in the league, 27-year-old retirement. How do you think we're looking for next year, regardless of where they play, hopefully in Chicago, but what's the prognosis for the team next year?
And DJ Moore.
DJ Moore traded to the Bills. Yeah.
This is going to be, a reflective offseason for the Bears. Everybody who watched Bears football this year realizes that we were, in total, right, in the aggregate, about eight plays away from going to the Super Bowl, right? And so when you look at that and you look at how much energy was brought to this city based on what they were able to do on the football field, I'm really excited about next year. I'm really excited about Ben Johnson. We've got some holes in the defense for sure. We need somebody who can rush. We need some stronger folks at safety. We got to be able to protect the quarterback's blind side, obviously. We got a left tackle situation there. I know there's been a lot of conversation about Dan Roschar and what he has said about his tackle room. Roschar was on the coaching staff at Illinois when I was there, so I know him well, and he knows what he's talking about. And then obviously the big loss in the middle of the line, that is, to me, bittersweet, because I love when a guy can walk away on his own terms as a young man with his body and his mind intact, but it's going to leave a huge gap for this team. And so I'm excited. I think they'll make some good moves in the offseason. Obviously, having the 25th pick in the draft is low, but it gives you the ability to kind of drown out all the noise and go with target and focus and get what you need to get. And so I'm excited about what Ryan and Ben are putting together. I think it's going to be a good ride.
Football talk with the state rep, Cam Buckner. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face Off. Tina is a partner at Deckard LLP and global co-chair of the firm's intellectual property practice. She has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martin Del Hubble and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers and Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. For more than 150 years, Deckard has advised the innovators who move industries forward. From the railroad pioneers of the 19th century to the world's top asset managers today, Deckard helps leaders uncover opportunity and unlock advantage. If you would like to learn more about Christina Martini and Deckard, visit Deckard.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. The father of the Georgia teen who went on a shooting rampage at a school, killing two students and two staff members back in September of 2024, has been convicted of a murder charge. We're seeing this more and more. Illinois, Michigan, now Georgia, where parents are being held responsible for their actions of their children. David Reedman joins us to talk about it. He has a PhD in AI. He's a professor, podcast host, a Brazilian jiu-jitsu coach, and founder of the K-12 school shooting database. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, happy to be on today. Thank you.
So, David, earlier this week, as Ryan said, a Georgia jury convicted Colin Gray of second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter for the 2024 Appalachian High School shooting in which his son, Colt Gray, is charged with killing four people. Tell us more about this verdict.
Yeah, this was a school shooting committed by a 14-year-old student who took an AR-15 rifle on the school bus, wrapped in a poster board, carried it into the school, and then committed a school shooting that morning. A couple important notes on that. Before the shooting occurred, family members knew there was a problem. His mother called the school to warn them that a shooting is about to happen. And it turns out that there had been extensive police and social services interventions, at least six different police agencies and five different social service agencies had been in contact with this family. One interview that was recorded the summer before, the perpetrator made a threat, a specific threat about the school shooting online. The FBI found it. They notified local police. Local police went out to interview the father and the son. And at that point, the father said, "There's no problem here. My kid would never do this." Meanwhile, he knew his son had a shrine to the Parkland shooter in his bedroom. He knew that he had purchased an AR-15 rifle for his son for Christmas because he wanted them to be able to bond over it. This was a father who knew that his son was suicidal, homicidal, worshiping school shooters, involved in online discussions about school shooters, and in possession of an AR-15 rifle. And I think that is why there was just such an egregious kind of act by the father here, and then the public backlash to say action needs to be taken legally.
So, you know, before this case, before the Crumley case, which was really, you know, the Michigan shooter was really the first of its kind, these cases were generally treated as misdemeanors. Why is there now this trend to hold the parents directly responsible in some of these kind of shootings?
Well, that was a misconception, actually, that I tried to correct when the Oxford shooting happened, because going back to 2000, there was a little girl, a six-year-old girl named Kayla Rollin, and she was fatally shot by another six-year-old student at her elementary school. It was Buell Elementary in Mount Mords Township, Michigan. And so she's a little girl killed by a little boy. That's below the age for any criminal charges, but there was incredible public backlash. So the uncle who owned the weapon was charged with involuntary manslaughter. He was also charged with a federal gun offense. He was sentenced to 15 years of prison. Two other adults who were also in the home had felony convictions that came out of that case. So that was back in 2000. And that was because the public backlash was so strong that they had to find a way to charge this uncle. And if you think about an uncle who left a gun in a house and then that gun is subsequently used in a shooting, that's kind of a pretty far stretch, but they got the conviction. And that's been kind of the case with parents charged. It's when there's public backlash, we find ways to create ways to charge them. The six-year-old who shot his teacher in Southern Virginia in 2022, there is no safe storage law in that state. There's no state that requires parents to keep a gun in a safe, to keep it away from children. So when that case happened and there was nothing at the state level to charge that mother with, they said that she lied on her ATF firearm form because they found trace amounts of marijuana in her house. And if you went through every gun owner in the country, you'd probably find millions of people that have technically lied on their ATF form. But that's what she was hit with the federal gun charge. So it's really, it comes down to, is there public will? Is there something that has really angered people to the point where politicians and state prosecutors or federal prosecutors will find a way to charge that parent?
So let's follow that thread for a second, David. As you noted at the top of our interview, the circumstances here were pretty egregious as they related to the father in this case. To what extent do you think this case is going to be likely to create precedent, even in those cases where maybe the father's actions or inactions were as egregious as they were here?
I think it comes down to state-level politics in a lot of cases, because in 2024, very similar circumstance where a 15-year-old girl opened fire inside her school in Madison, Wisconsin. And then it turned out that the father had been taking her to a gun club, had bought her two pistols, which she had open access to. She knew the codes to the gun safe. And then in the pictures he'd posted on social media, she was wearing one of the iconic Columbine t-shirts in those pictures at the gun club. So she was sending these warnings. She had also a shrine to school shooters. She had a very active social media presence where she was talking to mass shooters, to other kids who've committed school shootings. She was involved in the true crime community, TCC, which has been the common thread across school shooters. Her father should have known all of these things, but ultimately he was not charged in that case because Wisconsin is very different politically than some other states are. So I think it comes down to, is there public outrage against that parent? Or do they see a parent sympathetically as, I'm a gun owner, lots of us are gun owners. If we set this precedent, then, you know, this could happen to me.
Professor, I mean, in this case, it seems like, you know, there were incredibly obvious signs, right? I mean, we all saw the shrine on this kid's wall that the father missed. And, you know, this father was quoted as saying on the stand, he said, this is a good kid. Every parent thinks their kid is a good kid. Are there, you know, other warning signs that the law recognizes that are not as obvious as a shrine? I mean, a shrine seems, you know, like a slam dunk for the prosecution, but what other kind of legal responsibilities are being imposed on parents in these situations?
It's difficult because we just have a really patchwork set of laws, because really the only way that a parent can be charged is, first, do they have a responsibility to keep the gun secured in the house? And that's about half of states in the country have a law that requires guns to be stored in a locked container. And then is there a law saying that children under 18, minors in that house, cannot access firearms? And only about half of states have one of those laws. A couple states have both of them. If you don't have either of those laws, then it's not the parent's responsibility to keep their gun out of the hands of a child. And in some places, if they're allowed to legally purchase guns that they're gifted or given to their kids, then you're into kind of these legal gray areas. I think what really got the attention in Oxford, Michigan, is in that case, there were a long trail of text messages between the 15-year-old shooter and his parents saying that I'm suicidal, I'm hearing voices, I want to commit violence, I want a gun. And when you have that paper trail combined with the shooter's bedroom, where the only thing he had on the wall was a human target, didn't have any pictures, didn't have any comic books, all he had was his shooting range targets on the wall of his room. And then his parents went and bought him the gun when they knew he was already in that mental state. Then the parents there in Michigan were in the guidance counselor's office after he'd drawn images of a school shooting on a school assignment. And they didn't mention to the school counselor, oh, we bought him this gun and it might be in his backpack right now. I think that's where you get a manslaughter charge out of this. With Colin Gray, the police were there on the front porch. He didn't mention, I just bought my son an AR-15. And he didn't mention that I've been really worried about all of this different social service contact, our family situation, things that he's doing on the internet, things that he's involved in online, this shrine in his bedroom. It was the father's omission when he had that opportunity with the officers at the door. And instead, he was deceptive.
Professor, after the Parkland High School shooting in 2018, you founded the K-12 school shooting database. as an acknowledgement that school shooting should be thought of in the same way that terrorist attacks and natural disasters are. Can you tell us more about the database and the impact it's had?
And my background is in Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And there's a global terrorism database of every single terrorist attack that's taken place back to the 1960s across the entire world. I worked a number of years in the Federal Emergency Management Agency. You can search every single declared disaster, type of disaster that's impacted the U.S. since the 1970s. With school shootings, when Parkland happened and I wanted to learn about them, you could not provide easily what is the who, what, where, when, and why of school shootings. If you don't know why they're happening, you don't know if something's changing. If you don't know how many are happening, you don't know if it's getting better or worse. If you don't have a baseline every year, you don't know if interventions are effective. You don't know if school securitization is effective. So I just wanted to create objective information that could provide kind of empirical evidence about this problem. And it's now the basis for more than 500 academic papers. I've done hundreds of media interviews about it. I've done my own PhD research on using artificial intelligence for assessing threats of violence at schools. That is all based on being able to say this is the who, what, where, when, and why, along with about 200 other variables about more than 3,000 incidents back to the 1960s.
All right, so we'll have to leave it there. David Riedman, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Take care. Thank you so much.
It's primary season, and in Cook County, Illinois, there's some hotly contested races for seats. Many people probably don't follow closely, usually, until now, like for the Property Tax Appeal Board called the Board of Review. And she's in the middle of fighting it to keep that political seat. Samantha Steele, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So, Commissioner, yeah, great to have you on. The Cook County Board of Review has a lot of power. Many people perhaps don't know, but the power is over property tax appeals. This affects, of course, millions of parcels of land. Why do you think this office has become such a high-profile political battleground right now?
Well, I don't know if it's right now. Over the last 4 or 5 years, I would say the office has really come to light because of the power that it holds. You know, and historically, Cook County has we have the highest property tax rate in the country, which is not, you know, the number one spot anyone wants to be in. and then, you know, just historically, there's been such mismanagement in property taxes in Cook County, right? Like our former Speaker of the House made millions of dollars on his property tax appeal business. And so I just think that people in general, the regular constituents, property taxpayers are more aware of what the office and what it can do for them.
All right, so let's get into it. Your feud with Fritz Kagi over property taxes has been very public. Who do you think ultimately bears responsibility when homeowners are seeing these big increases?
So let's just talk about like the property tax system in Cook County. We are the largest county in the country that has the market value approach to properties. We're the second largest county in the country. So LA County does acquisition value, which we don't do, and we don't want to do that. So Cook County hasn't had a physical inspection of the data. So the assets that we have, there's no like audit that has been done to make sure that the data we have is accurate since 1997. So the year I graduated from high school was the last time people have done a systematic approach to looking at what's on the tax roll. I wouldn't say that I have a negative relationship with Fritz. I did want to run for assessor. I unfortunately was not born wealthy, so I didn't have the money to run that campaign. But, you know, there are many things that I feel that he has not done that should have been done to improve the property tax system in Cook County. And I have 20 years in the, you know, appeal or the property tax industry. I was a county assessor in Indiana. I was the first Democrat elected countywide in Tippecanoe County. So where Purdue University is. I was a 27-year-old single mom. And so it was, you know, baptismal by fire, as they say. And I was forced to learn everything there is to know about property valuations, appeals ratio studies, all of the, you know, coefficient of dispersion, all of the stuff that most people don't even know. I've been doing it since 2007. And I have a company that teaches this across the country. I do work nationally for the International Association of Assessing Officials, and I hold the highest degree in valuation in the state of Illinois. There are only four of us that have this designation. And so I have more of an intimate knowledge than most people, even you know, the current assessor, Fritz Kagi, have. So whenever I see things that are just common practices in other jurisdictions and we're not doing that, I feel that we are not giving our taxpayers the service that they deserve.
I have one question for you, because we just got done talking with Cam Buckner about the Bears and keeping the Bears in Illinois. He'd like them to stay in Chicago, obviously. But how does that all play into effect? We've been talking a lot about property taxes, especially in Arlington Heights. How is that related to anything that you've been working on or anything you're considering?
Oh, well, you know, I don't know if you heard, but I got fined. I had a $4,000 ethics fine for talking about the Bears appeal, which was a political move. I personally would love to see the Bears stay in Chicago. And I love Cam Buckner, just for the record. He's a fantastic legislator, really cares about the community. But, you know, the Bears, when I spoke about the Bears and people were like, oh, the way you said it was like, you don't like the Bears. No, I was giving the facts. Like, the assessor, the Bears purchased that property. The assessor assessed the property for exactly what the Bears purchased it for. In our industry, that's called sales chasing. There are other, you know, intangible assets that go with buying commercial property, and especially something of that caliber, that scale. And then I was quoted as saying, you know, the Bears are going to have to file an appeal next year. They're going to have to appeal again next year, is how the quote came. And I was like, yeah, Churchill Downs owned it the year before. The Bears owned it now. They're the ones that are going to have to file the appeal the next year. So, you know, I think that the Bears bring a lot of revenue into whatever community that they're in. And obviously, you know, Chicago is very proud. Like, we're very proud of our sports teams. We're very proud of our ways of life. And that the Bears are part of our fabric. And so I would love to see them stay, you know, in Cook County, preferably, right? But downtown is a great place. And I think no matter what happens with the Soldier Fields, that, you know, that venue needs to be revamped. Like, I don't know if you've ever been to a game there or a concert, but I think about it, like, if there's a fire, how are you getting out of here? So, you know, that is something that we're going to have to look at as, you know, as a community, because that is going to be an expense for all of us to bear.
Commissioner, what are some key differences that you want voters to know about you versus your Democratic primary challenger, Liz Nicholson?
So, well, one, I'm qualified, right? She has no experience in valuation whatsoever. She is has been a political fundraiser. She's worked for, you know, the Michael Madigan machine politics. She was let go from her position. She separated ways from her position as the Senate Dems fundraiser under, you know, there's an NDA. Some reports have said that she wrote herself $72,000 in bonuses. And so I'm like, do you want that person making billions of dollars of decisions and for our communities and schools? And I personally do not. And so it's a matter of, this is a technical position. It's not a political, it shouldn't be a political position. If we put both of our resumes down, you know, she would be an entry level, if that, in this industry.
Got it. And finally, from my perspective, are there any specific reforms that you can tell voters about that you would implement if elected?
Yeah, so I am finishing up my first term. And in our first term, I initiated what we call the STAR program. It's to standardize the appeal process, saving, you know, individual residential property tax owners thousands of dollars. They don't have to hire an attorney to file the appeal. My staff does it for them. We throughout this past year, we did 42 appeal outreaches in the district. And then in this last year, I won 4 national awards for the work that I've initiated over the three years that I've been in office. And so I would continue that work that we've already done. I'm working on, it's in a draft format right now, but an operational manual. So the individuals making decisions on your property taxes are qualified and have to follow, you know, the standard procedures. And so I would just continue the good work that we've done. And we had 540,000 parcels appeal this last year. So it's a lot of work.
What do these last 11 days look like for you here headed into the primary then? A lot of shaking hands, a lot of visiting places, a lot of going to churches and schools. What does the next couple weeks look like?
I think it's more now as I get out the vote, working polls. You know, this rain today was a little, my hair, I'm like a drenched rat because I was outside asking, you know, people to consider me for as they were going into the polls. So a lot of I have a community meet and greet on Monday and my final fundraiser on Thursday. So if you want to come, Bellevue at 6 p.m. Thursday, be my guest. And then, yeah, just wrapping it up. It's 11 days. Seems like it's so far, but that it'll be here before you know it.
Sure. Samantha Steele with the Cook County Board of Review. Thanks for coming on with us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you guys for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on WGNRadio.com. Kansas State's basketball coach went on a rant about his players. Now, the school doesn't want him to pay him out the $18 million he still owed on his contract. Gabe Feldman's a professor and director of sports law and the associate provost of NCAA compliance at Tulane University. Thanks for coming on with us, Gabe. Welcome to March Madness, I suppose.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, Professor Tang went on this rant. You know, of course, it went viral. He called his team embarrassing. He stated they don't deserve to wear the uniform and said that a lot of the roster may turn over. After that, he was fired, which we'll get into. But, you know, can comments like that be classified as cause legally in a coaching contract?
Generally not. It depends on the language of the contract. And what we've seen with coaching contracts is they have evolved over time. And the termination provisions, in some cases, are multiple pages long to try to put the school in a position, if they have leverage, to allow them to terminate for lots of different reasons. This seems like it would be tough to be able to prove, but it depends, again, what the language of the contract says. Because if I'm the coach or the coach's lawyer, I'm arguing this is just typical motivational tactics. This is nothing that is unexpected. This is nothing that would ridicule or bring disrepute to the program. This is just designed to motivate and just part of coaching.
So Professor Tang reached the Elite Eight in his first season, but the program declined afterward. How much does his record matter if the school claims this was a conduct-based firing?
Almost none. So we've seen in a few cases that employers have tried to fire coaches for cause because they failed to win, and have argued that's the whole point of your job. And if you're not performing your job, we have cause to fire you. It's been very difficult to do because there are so many things that can lead to losses on the court or on the field that aren't necessarily in the control of the coach. So the coach may do everything the same from one year to the next, but if a player gets injured or they get a bad bounce or whatever it might happen, it's typically not seen as cause for firing based on a win-loss record. And that goes the other way, though. Just because you have a great win-loss record doesn't mean you can't be fired if you do something that violates the specific clauses of your termination provision, like potentially getting arrested, committed an NCAA violation. Something in terms of speech, though, that's where it becomes a fuzzier line. And it would likely, again, come down to the specific terms of the contract. But being a winning coach is not going to protect you from being fired for cause. It just might make it less likely that they're willing to fire you because schools usually like winning more than anything else.
So speaking, Professor, of that specific contract language, in an effort to, again, avoid this $18 million buyout, the AD, Gene Taylor for Kansas State, said that Tang's comments and conduct, in addition to the program's overall direction, have not aligned with K-State's standards for supporting student-athletes and representing the university. He said that the coverage of this rant could potentially bring embarrassment to the institution. What are your thoughts there?
I mean, that's what they have to argue because that's what the language says in the contract, and that's pretty standard in a morals clause or a for-cause provision in a contract. But it's one thing to have that language, and typically the contracts will say that this is in the sole discretion of the school or the coach, and they get to determine what constitutes conduct detrimental or bring disrepute. But in general, courts have been willing or have read in a good faith requirement in there, that even if it seems to give all of the power to the employer, they're still going to require the employer to exercise that power in good faith and not try to use this as just a hook to fire a coach who's not doing as well on the court without having to pay them. And so it's ultimately be up to, if it gets to a jury, for the jury to decide or for the judge to decide whether this is sufficient to constitute cause. But again, I think this would potentially open the door to a lot of schools being able to fire their coaches just because they said something publicly that they claim brought disrepute to the school. And if that's the result, then I think what we'd likely see happen is coaches who have leverage would be very careful in negotiating future contracts to say, to limit how they can be terminated for cause. Because as you said, this is a multi-million dollar question. And so I understand the school's argument, and I understand what the coach is going to say, and then we'd have to see if this case goes to trial, how it ultimately be decided, but there's no clear answer to it.
So Professor Tang's lawyers are reportedly raising the issue of actual malice in statements that have been made about him. What does actual malice mean legally, and how hard is that standard to prove?
Well, that would be more for the defamation case and claiming that they are harming his reputation, and actual malice is required when it is a public figure. And Coach Tang will be a public figure. And so it's not just enough to have said something false. You have to be aware that it was false and have intended it to harm the person. It's a very, very high standard to prove, very difficult burden. And that's intentional, because if it is a public figure, we want to give people the right to criticize them. And we don't want them to be able to avoid criticism for fear of a lawsuit. And so the defamation claim, the actual malice, again, you see that alleged a lot and pled a lot, but it's very difficult to prove. And it might be just a leverage piece to try to negotiate a better settlement.
Professor, it's fair to say that in college basketball and college sports in general, but of course, college basketball, college football, this is the era of player empowerment. Players are stronger than ever. They have NIL deals that's fueling a lot of that. They have the transfer portal. They're able to skip from school to school. How do you think that dynamic is affecting this issue? Are coaches' contracts going to be less enforceable? Do coaches generally have less power, especially when they're criticizing these players who are, in many cases, you know, funding a lot of these programs?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think a couple of things might happen. One is that in the old way of doing things, the best way to recruit an athlete was to hire a great coach and to pay that coach a lot of money to keep them there and then have great facilities and to win. Now there's a more direct way to recruit those athletes, and that's to pay them or to arrange for NIL deals for them. So I do think that the coach may lose a little bit of their leverage because they're looking as the school to try to attract the best players. And yeah, a coach helps, but it's not maybe as important as it once was, because if you have to ask a player, you can either go to school with a mediocre coach and get $1 million a year, or go to school with one of the best coaches in the country and get $0. I guess you might get different answers depending on the athlete, but I do think more athletes would say, give me the $1 million and the mediocre coach, and I'll figure out what to do with that. So I do think the coaches may have less leverage overall. I don't think that changes, though, for the coaches at the very top level, because what we've seen, we saw it with the recent hire with LSU, and we've seen the movement all with these top football coaches primarily, that they're in such high demand, even with all the athlete empowerment and athlete pay, that schools are going to bend over backwards to get them. And that may include signing a contract that is very beneficial to the coach, not only in terms of the compensation, but in terms of the buyout right or the termination clause. And LSU just signed high-profile football coach and with no offset requirement. And so there are certain coaches who are going to keep getting more. And the top coaches, I think, will continue to do that despite what's happening in the overall landscape. But I think more in the middle and the bottom, we are going to see coaches perhaps have less leverage and these contracts be a little more school-friendly than coach-friendly.
Professor Gabe yes. Feldman, thank you so much for joining us. And I have to say, I think you have one of the coolest microphones we've ever had on Legal Face-Off. Am I wrong?
I appreciate it. It's a gaming mic. I didn't realize that when I bought it, but it looks cool, so I'm sticking with it.
It's great. Like for the people listening, it glows. It's really, really cool. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. Tiffany M. Hughes is the managing partner of Tiffany M. Hughes Family Law Attorneys with a Chicago headquarters, also a Florida office. Looks like you got Chicago behind you, though, so you'll be representing from the north today. All right, and in this corner, we have Simon Kishishian, the vice president for risk management and risk counsel at Red Bull. He's in Santa Monica, my favorite Everclear song. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you for having me.
And let's get it going here. We start with the heavy stuff. Trump watch, Iran. Rich, what direction do you want to go with Trump, Iran? It's changing every second.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were talking about the war, the action, the regime change, however you want to classify it, that's going on in Iran. Of course, the legal question is whether Trump has the authority to act the way he did. Not that it matters, Tina, really. We know that in the Trump area, the convenient thing of the law doesn't really matter so much. But, you know, he went in and attacked Iran and took out the leader. And, of course, Democrats and many Republicans actually are saying that he did not do so in concert with the Constitution. Of course, the Constitution requires that a president go to Congress and justify and get permission from Congress to go to war. Trump is claiming that this is not a war and that it was in self-defense. You know, the exception to that, as we've seen, is that if the action is in the self-defense of the country, and he's tried to explain it that way, that, you know, Iran was on the verge of developing a bomb that could reach U.S. soil. They've been saying that for years. There's no evidence of that. And again, they didn't go to Congress to get that approval. That's not the way this administration does that. To be fair, many other administrations have, you know, done the same thing, but not to this extent, not where, you know, we literally, for the first time in many years, took out a leader of another country, and where already six American soldiers have died. So a lot more egregious case of skirting the Constitution, in my opinion.
I agree, Rich, with everything you said. What's interesting is I've been watching Homeland for the first time the last few weeks, and there's interesting parallels between that show. You're smiling because I think you actually watched that show when it originally aired, if I remember correctly. But it's interesting just, you know, the way you framed it is correct, that this has been the story, the narrative for years with respect to Iran, as evidenced by that show, as was evidenced by things that were in motion well before that. And I agree, this is just another data point of the administration, I think, you know, sort of pushing the limits in terms of what it does without sort of the balance of powers being implemented here.
Yeah. And Tiffany, it's been many days, and I still don't have a clear answer from the administration as to why we're committed to this war. I mean, is it gas? Is it a nuclear bomb? Is it to support our ally Israel? I mean, they've been given probably six or seven different reasons, none of which has been a consistent message.
Well, Trump said numerous times that he's going to do what he wants to do. I think that maybe correct me, guys, if I'm wrong, but I think this issue was brought up before the House and the Senate, and it was voted down. So he was still allowed to have this power. And now all of a sudden they want to do something about it because, you know, obviously it's to such an extreme at this point. But I mean, it's sad. It's really sad.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And Simon, I mean, the basic idea is pretty simple, that, you know, before you commit American lives to danger like this, you should have at least the support of a majority of the people, as exemplified by their representatives, and have a clear reason, right? We learned that from Vietnam and some other events, that this is not the way things are supposed to go in a democracy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that stands out for me is the messaging that we've seen from the White House and how this is a righteous cause. And to your point, Rich, I'm not sure that they've laid out the basis of that righteousness. And I mean, it's no joking matter when American lives are being lost. And this isn't just us remotely dropping a bunch of bombs with drones. And what concerns me even more for a guy that travels internationally like you do, Rich, is that what impact does this have on our allies and what's going on in other parts of the world, where we've started seeing some footage from the Middle East where, you know, people are at a resort in what was it, Dubai, and there's buildings blowing up. It's just not only isn't it a good look, but it puts pressure on. It's not just us. It puts pressure on our partners. So, I mean, I guess the theory is don't let the Constitution get in the way of our ability to show our might. But yeah, it leaves me questioning what the motives are, and you know, the legality, I think, is obviously in question as well. So, interesting times.
I have a feeling we're going to be talking about Iran quite a bit in the coming episodes. All right, Tina, the next story you threw in the bag, and I kind of feel sad about this one, the latest drama for Britney Spears.
Yeah, Ryan, I agree. So earlier this week, she was arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence in Southern California. She ended up being released the following day. Her vehicle had been towed. She was arrested driving erratically in Ventura County. Apparently she was driving not just erratically, but she was also driving at a very high speed on the 101. She was pulled over, showed signs of impairment, was given field sobriety tests, and was arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence of a combination of drugs and alcohol. She was the only person in the car. Apparently the results of the testing are still pending and the incident's being investigated. What I find particularly sad, and this may be what you're referencing, Ryan, is what her representative said, which was that this was an unfortunate incident that's completely inexcusable and that she needs to take the right steps to try to institute long overdue change in her life. And also went on to say that her loved ones are going to be helping her to come up with a plan to set her up for success. This is not the only recent data point for Britney Spears. Apparently her Instagram account is now down, but there had been a number of strange videos that she had been posting showing herself dancing alone in her home. She had also posted a video of herself with a shaved head hitting a car with an umbrella. And so apparently there are a bunch of people who have said all these things that are pretty recent seem to indicate that she is in need of help and our people are concerned about her mental health. We covered several years ago how her conservatorship had ended with her father. And a lot of people are thinking, Rich, that she is in a tough spot right now again.
Yeah, I mean, she probably needs more help. Interestingly, in the last 24 hours, her first husband, I believe, Jason Alexander, not Simon, not George from Seinfeld, but the other Jason Alexander, her childhood friend, who she married for like, what, 48 hours or something? He came out and said, she only blew a .06, which in California is legally drunk, but in many states falls below the .08 standard. And, you know, take it easy on her. I mean, I don't buy that, you know. Drunk is drunk, according to the law. So, I think we sympathize, but at some point you got to take responsibility and, you know, get out of this this habit of blaming others. And, you know, I feel bad for her kids. She's got the two kids with K-Fed. I think they're like 19 and 20 now. So not far from you, Simon, where you are right now. Or is she in Ventura, right?
Yeah, I mean, Ventura's not, I'm not that far from Ventura. They don't let me in the city that often. But yeah, to your point, the blood alcohol was that she blew was apparently a .06, and California is actually .08. So she was below on the blood alcohol, but it sounds like there might have been a synergistic effect of some of the other stuff that might have been in her system. So they arrested her anyway. Well, they arrested her, and then they took her to a hospital and had her blood drawn. You know, if anybody does criminal defense, it's an interesting thing because how long an amount of time transpired between her arrest and her getting her blood work done, and could that have sort of reduced the blood alcohol content percentage? But I think that's going to be a point of a strong defense. If I'm sure she's going to hire a criminal defense attorney. But to Christina's point, that publicist statement seemed like, first of all, I think the expectation is that somebody knows, like, you don't send that statement out on day one unless you know that there's been issues. And I think if you follow some of the people that do follow her, not me anymore, although the remix for the Westlake Village version, I'm going to be checking out that Oops, I Did It Again remix soon, coming out on my channel. No, I'm kidding. But it's apparently there seems to be a course of dealing or a history there. And so hopefully this is the catalyst of her going and seeking treatment if that's what she needs. But I don't know that it's going to get a lot of traction with the fact that her blood alcohol standing alone was below the legal limit. I don't know how you get a DUI if you don't blow over 0.08, but yeah. I don't think it'll work. I just know some criminals.
Tiffany, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think it was not only the drinking, but it was also like some like drugs or other substance. So it was driving under the influence, which I guess in California must mean more than just alcohol. Sure. But I think that, like, I think generally, I think we've seen her, unfortunately, like spiraling for a while. You know, though, I think I was actually on with you guys when we were talking about the conservatorship that with her dad, and that it was sad, like the way that that was working out and how he was like making money off of it and like funneling money and like supposedly. And the control that the ultimate control that he had over her. But then that ended, and now here we are, and here she is again, you know, getting in trouble. And I can tell you, I've seen the things that she's posted, and like you can clearly see that there's something wrong. I mean, I'm not a medical professional, so I can't say what's wrong, but there's definitely mental health issues. And with that, unfortunately, we also see that people end up wind up in the system, and they end up, you know, committing crimes. And to the point of what the comment was, as far as from the one that said that the spokesperson, this is a unfortunate, whatever it was, unfortunate incident. I mean, to me, that sounds like an admission of guilt. I mean, I would be really upset with the fact that if you're going to plead not guilty, which I'm sure she's going to, that you just admitted that she's going to get help with her friends and her family and her adult sons, which, by the way, it's crazy that they're already adults. I feel extremely old. But yeah, Brittany needs help. And hopefully maybe this is the wake up call. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that'd be safe to say everyone would like to see her healthy and maybe touring again. I'm sure everyone would love to see the comeback, but it's got to be a healthy comeback. All right, Rich, you threw this one in the bag. You're very excited about this story, about this Louisiana mayor who threw a house party in 2024. I'll let you just go through and explain it all for us.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy story. This woman who's a mayor of DeRidder, Louisiana, Misty Roberts, she had a party, pool party in 2024. She was found guilty this week of having sex with a 16-year-old at this party at her house. She was found guilty of having sex with a juvenile. We also heard testimony that the day after she received a delivery of the day after pill. She faces up to 10 years in prison. There was a lot of evidence of, the evidence was, as you can imagine, at a party with a bunch of kids, there's phones everywhere. So the evidence was overwhelming. She had threatened some of the witnesses involved. She claimed that she was being railroaded. I mean, just overall a disgusting story, obviously, Tina. But I guess it just follows this line of stories we always cover where people just do the stupidest things. I mean, you know, like, did she think she wouldn't get caught? Did she think that ordering, the day after pill with a delivery service, that wouldn't have some kind of a record that would come after her? So I think 10 years is like getting off easy for this lunatic.
But you can get that stuff delivered on Amazon Eats now? I didn't know that. Thanks for that.
Apparently.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree, Rich. For somebody who is not a public figure to behave this way, it's awful enough. But for this person to be in a position like a mayor, to be behaving this way, to first of all be hosting a party like this, I understand sometimes people host parties like this for their kids. But you're supposed to be the adult. You're supposed to be the one who keeps order and, good common sense as the foundation of this type of a festivity, like a party, a gathering, and instead to be behaving this way. I mean, this is not an excuse. My guess is that she was probably pretty inebriated, but you shouldn't be letting yourself get to the point where you engage in behavior that is so lacking in judgment.
Yeah. Tiffany, anything else to add to this story?
I mean, you guys know that I'm a divorce attorney. I also am a guardian ad litem and a child representative. I represent children. I'm appointed by judges to represent children. It is so utterly disgusting to me that not only, like Tina said, like it's bad enough if like a private citizen or a private individual does this, but to be a mayor and to like have any, I mean, to have sex with a child is just disgusting. It's just so I just no words. To your point, Rich, I think 10 years is way not enough for a situation and a crime like this. And I think it sets you're kind of setting the stage of like, okay, well, you can have sex with a child and then you'll just get 10 years. And then they mention, oh, by the way, this is a person and this is a real, like this is their life. So maybe be like, kind to them. No way. I hope their community, I hope that everywhere around her, does what they should do and treat her accordingly, because it's not okay.
Well, it's all fun and games until someone gets hurt. And Tina, there was a huge snowball fight in New York City and a cop got hurt. That's bad.
Yeah, Ryan. So this is an interesting story. It's unfortunate that we had two NYPD officers who were injured in a snowball fight during a recent blizzard in New York. Police arrested a second person who's an 18-year-old and charged him with obstructing governmental administration and harassment. Interestingly, the first person who got charged and was ultimately released in the snowball fight is a 27-year-old man named Guzman Koulibaly, who apparently has another data point that we should consider here in terms of how he has previously acted. Earlier last month, he was harassing people in a Bronx subway station, pretending that these people who he came upon at the subway station owed him money. apparently was part of an ongoing stunt for his YouTube channel. And it was as a result of these pranks that he was filming in the subway. He posted himself as having the moniker Diaper Man. He pretended that all these strangers that he would encounter on the subway owed him money. And as a result, he actually really scared some people. He was seen in one of his videos asking a victim, "When are you going to pay me money?" The person said, "You've got, you know, this is a case of mistaken identity," and he started threatening people. So in any event, there were videos of this snowball fight. Mayor Mamdani came out and did a press conference about it. He said he's looked into it, and he said that he doesn't think anybody should be facing criminal charges for the snowball fight, that it was a snowball fight that got out of hand, but he didn't think anybody should be prosecuted. The NYPD commissioner, Jessica Tisch, though, does not agree with that, and said, you know, at the end of the day, our NYPD police force has enough to deal with, and they don't need to be threatened or to be hurt while wearing a uniform and trying to protect the city. Rich, I mean, this guy, this Yahoo from the subway, I mean, talk about, you know, how we discuss frequently people doing stupid things. This is just another person doing something incredibly stupid.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure most people have seen the video by now. And this is not just like a fun snowball fight. It was in Washington Square Park, hundreds and hundreds of people. And they're literally turning all of the attention to the cops, and they're attacking the cops with snowballs, many of which had like ice in it, other debris. And I mean, a couple of them went to the hospital. Listen, anytime you accept that someone's going to physically attack a cop, it's like you're chipping away a little bit of the order of our world. That shouldn't happen. And the worst part was Mamdani, you know, stupidly, in his first real test in dealing with cops as a mayor, he dismissed it as just a snowball fight and it's no big deal. And of course, that played into every conception that people had before he was elected that he would be anti-cop. What happens the first time that a cop is physically attacked under his watch, he plays off. And you know, he's at odds with Jessica Tisch, who's like a rising superstar, probably the next mayor of New York. So very dumb by him. And yeah, I mean, they should throw the book at these people who are, you know, throwing snowballs at cops, in my opinion. Simon.
I mean, I see
you
that
love snowball fight. I know you do.
I mean, we don't have a lot of snow out here on the west coast, but yeah. But when we do, my only comment is during the arraignment, prosecutor said they can't prove he caused the injury and all that. And my question is, what happened to the snow?
Yeah, the evidence is gone. Spoliation of evidence.
So, you know, I think they should be exculpated on that basis. But no, it's no joking matter. Battery is battery, whether it starts with whatever good fun. These aren't kids. This is the police. They're supposed to be law and order. And this is not a good thing. I don't recommend it. Now, if I see Rich walking down the streets of the Bronx, and there's a little bit of, it is what it is. You can't help yourself sometimes.
That's right. I mean, think about Elf, right? That New York.
That was a very endearing movie.
Snowballs. I mean, I think you got to ring him up. I don't know. We'll see. Rich is going to explain to us what an Alpine divorce is.
Well, I'm hoping that our guests can. But yeah, there's this trend, I guess, Tina, of this TikTok trend of men, mostly men, leaving their spouses on a trail or a ski trail as a means of breaking up. So instead of like the traditional, hey, I don't think this is working out, it's not you, it's me, over dinner, maybe even over a text, which isn't great either. But a text sure beats going on a hike with someone and leaving them in the middle of nowhere because you're done with them. That's the thing. I guess the term goes back to 1893 when there was a story revolving around a husband who planned to end his marriage by actually pushing his wife off a cliff in the Alps. But just last month, this term went viral when a woman said that her man had abandoned her on Valentine's Day on a hike, and that led to all these other women telling their stories of Alpine divorces. This clip was seen 21 million times. I don't know. I had never heard of it before this, but kind of a new low for breaking up.
I agree. Talk about being a weak idiot that you decide that instead of just looking someone in the eye and having a conversation and saying, this is not working, it's not you, it's me, whatever it is, but actually doing it in a conversation, you think it's better to take someone to the wilderness and leave them out in the elements, where actually there was somebody in Europe, they were saying, who was in a situation like this and ended up dying because she was exposed to the elements. Come on, seriously?
Yeah.
You are that weak of a person that you have to do this to somebody and you can't just break up with them on the phone or over a cup of coffee?
Yeah. Tiffany, this is your wheelhouse. Are you seeing this trend? And you represent people who are breaking up for a living. Is this something that's happening? Have you seen any evidence of this?
So I have never heard of this until today, which is crazy to me. First of all, like when you're married and if you were to do this to your spouse, like you're going to have to get divorced. So you're going to see the person again, right? It's different if like you're dating and then you just like, you know, you just like jump ship and you like leave them in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. Which is, I think it's crazy. It's just a crazy. And the fact that like, they must have looked it up or heard it or saw it or did something to know that this was even a thing is even crazier. So I wow. And to what Tina was saying is like, it's really dangerous, like to leave them in the middle of nowhere. And they're actually like, I watched the Instagram one that got like the 23 million views. And she's like legit afraid. I mean, she is like in the middle of nowhere. She doesn't know where she is. She doesn't know where to go. She tries to find somebody that's going to help her. I mean, unreal, unreal.
Well, you know, yeah. And Simon, the case that Tina's mentioning, we actually covered it in my other podcast, the Sermapod. This is the guy was found guilty of manslaughter. He left his girlfriend on a very dangerous hill in Austria. The weather was terrible. He went, he left her alone to get help, but ignored all sorts of signs and, you know, left her alone. And she died and he was found guilty of manslaughter.
You know, this is all very painful. Obviously, that's terrible, especially because I know a little bit about Austria, being that Red Bull's from there. But I'm beginning to realize this was news to me, too. I've never heard of this Alpine divorce thing. But I'll tell you, I'm beginning to wonder. My wife took me to the mall not too many times ago. And I felt kind of the same way. I was abandoned and I didn't know where to go and I didn't know what to do while she was off and about. I don't think Christina found that to be funny, but yeah, I tried.
She said, meet me between the Blockbuster and the JCPenney, and she never showed up.
No, I waited for her at Sears. I couldn't find her. I don't know what's going on. Anybody else out of business lately? Okay. That's not funny.
Circuit City was right after Circuit City.
All right. Well, we all know about Buc-ee's, that gas station chain that's got a bit of a cult following across the country. There's an Ohio company that has another chain. It's called Mickey's, and it features a moose. And Tina, the Buc-ee's folks don't seem to like that too much.
Oh, all I can do is say I do not see this. And I've been a trademark lawyer for 30 years. For those of us who are seeing this in our in the video portion of our program, this is just one of any number of lawsuits that Buc-ee's has filed over the past several years against any number of different types of businesses, with the theme being that there is some other kind of animal that is included in the logo. In this particular case, we've got a beaver versus a moose. Yes, they both have the overlap in terms of the fact that they're retailers. There's a grocery store element to Buc-ee's business. They're a fuel center operator in addition to a convenience store. Mickey Mart is, obviously a convenience store and gas station chain as well. Buc-ee's has been around since 1982. Mickey Mart's trademark has been around for the past 6 years. Buc-ee's is claiming trademark infringement and is seeking cancellation of Mickey Mart's registered trademark. Buc-ee's has a history of being incredibly aggressive against any number of other similar businesses, and maybe even not so similar businesses. Rich, I just don't see it. I do not see similarities. I can see with some of these other cases like Buc-ee's versus Barkies, which is a dog, I can understand the word element of the marks, that them being similar. Then there's this Born United logo, where it looks exactly like the Bucky's Beaver logo, except dressed in camo instead. But there's any number of these, including one against Ducky's. I just don't see some of these, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a classic case of like the big dog bullying everyone else. You know, like being a Canadian myself and knowing how regal and important the beaver is. I mean, there's like a million logos in Canada that Bucky's could go after. Like, you know, there's like a big crafty beaver chain in Canada that like has a beaver in their logo. So they can't own the beaver logo, let alone all these other animals. I mean, what's the nexus between a moose and a beaver? You know, they're both looking the same direction. They're both smiling, but I mean, you're not going to have an angry moose as your logo, you know? So, and you know, this logo is like so important to Bucky's. I get it. Like if you go to their stores, this logo Bucky is slapped on every damn thing they're selling. So I get it. And, you know, there's a theory behind being first, like being very aggressive at first because you're going to dissuade anyone with your might. But it just seems like bullying. I don't know. Any similarity? Would you, any of you, Simon or Tiffany, be confused if you went to any of these other establishments?
I think this is all a big moose steak. Mistake?
Well, as someone who's in... works for a very, very important brand, Simon. We need your opinion.
Yeah, look, I don't see it either. These logos are very different. I mean, the whole idea of having a cartoonish element to it is as far as it goes. The colors aren't the same, and I'm no trademark attorney, but I have heard that Red Bull has enforced some of its designs and over the years, and we were once accused of being Red Bully instead of Red Bull. But I don't see it. I think this is just them trying to protect whatever they're trying to protect. Those dolls are cute when you go to the Bucky's. I'd never been or heard of Bucky's, frankly. But I'm from Texas originally, and I was in Austin literally a month and a half ago. And my kid says, you got to go to this Bucky's and you got to have this barbecue sandwich. And I will tell you, they were delicious. That's all I've got. I don't know anything else, but this goes nowhere fast. But you know what? Somebody's getting good publicity for it. So maybe that's the goal. I say we don't talk about it anymore.
How did Born United get away with it? I mean, look at that one.
Yeah, that
is crazy to me.
Yeah, that is crazy. I mean, that's literally like lifting the logo and just changing the outfit.
I mean, it's a helmet. It's a helmet. Come on. That's way different from the very gentle Bucky on the other side.
Oh yeah, that sound okay. Now you're sounding like Vanilla Ice when he was talking about how Ice Baby didn't sound like Under Pressure.
You know what? I've got it, and you know he sold it, and then he admitted later on that he jacked it. So that was the best part of that, right? But what you know what Bucky's really saying is that there's a damn problem here. Okay, all right. That's all I've got for today. Okay. I can keep on going, but we don't have that kind of time.
I love it.
They all look like Cub Scout patches to me, really, when you look at them, don't they?
Yeah. I mean,
they look like they should be on some kid's vest who's trying to sell you something. So,
do you want one? I can get you one.
I don't want no stinking cookies, I'll tell you. But I'll tell you that barbecue sandwich, it was definitely worth the visit in the middle of nowhere.
Are they paying you, Simon?
Yeah.
They are not.
All right. Well, it's been well established here on Legal Face Off that pickleball people are the worst. They're mean. They get into fights. Unproven that they kick puppies when they're not playing. And those who live near pickleball courts don't like the constant noise. So they're basically skateboard parks for hoodlums in their 50s. That's my take. Rich, what do you say?
I mean, first of all, you have to almost play. If you're a Karen or the male equivalent, you're almost guaranteed to be a pickleball player too, right? I mean, so this is just a Karen lawsuit of people who are unhappy with the sound. There's been a ton of these stories. I think a couple episodes ago, we covered the pickleball fight, also in Florida, where these old-timers were slamming each other with pickleballs because of an argument about being in the kitchen. In this case, two families in Boca Raton are suing because of the sound. Tina, they're saying that the noise that Ryan so ably recreated just now reaches 73 decibels, violating the 55 decibel limit for what the city will qualify as a nuisance. And they're so close, and it bothers their lives. So I don't know. I'm a pickleball player myself. I find the sound
Shocker.
Very beautiful and intoxicating. So I would I would deny this motion automatically.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I can kind of see both sides of this. I think part of the issue also is not just the sound of the that Ryan did such a wonderful job recreating, but it's also the loud music allegedly that is played by the pickleball players. Apparently there's some restrictions that the homeowners association has with respect to days of the week that can be where pickleball can be played. Apparently people are playing even when they're not supposed to be in terms of days of the week. So I can see both sides to this, Rich. You know, I find tennis to be a loud sport as well, just as loud as pickleball, in my humble opinion. And pickleball is creating a lot more controversy about these sorts of things than tennis ever did.
We're going to volley this one to you, Simon, to start. Pro or anti-pickleball noise?
I'm anti-noise, period, whether it's pickleball or loud music or whatever else. I am not quite old enough to play pickleball yet. I'm still in my earlier 50s, but
right. But
I think what I'm going to do for sport is not play pickleball. I'm going to join an HOA. And it's Boca Raton, which, by the way, the demographic, I think there's a requirement that you have to be over the speed limit before you can even enter into the community. I'm just saying, I haven't been to Boca Raton lately. I'm not sure that any of this is helpful, but I don't like noise, so I get it.
Move the hell away from the rest of society, Simon.
I got to get away from the
society with people who make noise, goddammit. All right, Tiffany.
Okay, so I just want to say I've never played pickleball, although I know a lot of people that play, and I heard great things about it. I laughed when I...
Many divorces, by the way.
Is this another spokesperson?
Many marriages have ended because of pickleball.
So when I first saw the article and was reading it, I was just laughing about it because I thought it was a joke. But then as I was like looking into it, I mean, the pickleball court is actually in the middle of the homes where, like in Florida, where I have a home and where I go to, it's like far away from everything. It's not near any homes. So when they were saying like, it has to be 600 feet away from homes, I kind of get it. And then, I think you were saying like the noise of the people that play tennis, like all you hear is like the noises from them. I don't know if pickleball is the same thing, but if it's anything like tennis, it sounds like people are getting injured because they're so loud. If you've ever seen the matches. So I don't know. Like Tina, I have to agree with her. I can see it both ways.
All what right, kind of well, music do you think they're blasting out there? Eagles?
Yeah, I mean, they're 80-year-old Rush.
Phil Collins.
Phil Collins, very good.
Here we go. I was going to say Metallica. We've Take got me some home. Yeah. Seniors.
I was thinking Antonio Vivaldi or Beethoven or something jamming, which could be worse, in fact, when you're not calling me.
We're going to end off with this question to all of you, unprepared, unplanned. If you could file a lawsuit for one sound that you want to take off this planet, what sound would it be? Ryan, we're going to start with you. What sound would you outlaw?
Garbage truck, the old 7 a.m. garbage truck.
Ironically, the lawsuit said that this was louder than the sound of a garbage truck backing up. So you got a good one. Simon, what sound would you outlaw if you could?
You know, every time I'm on a call on a Tuesday morning, it's the weed whacker guys that come in. They're like a gang of them, and they come in because it's an HOA. And I'm telling you, I could do without it.
Good one. Tiffany, what are you suing to outlaw?
So I would have to say people that chomp when they eat. Yeah. Yep. That noise literally kills me.
There's a word for that, by the way. I don't know.
Yeah, there is. My husband has that too.
Don't like the sound of
chompers. I can't even chew gum around my husband because like, even if I just put the piece of gum in my mouth and suck on it, he's like, I hear you sucking on your gum rather than chewing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you add no.
We used to call that ruthless and toothless, but that may be something else.
Yes. Tina, what do you got? I got so many. I'm just waiting.
Car alarms.
Car alarms.
Gosh, good one. Yeah. They don't really have those
What's
anymore.
What's the point of a car alarm?
I still hear them.
Last time you heard a car alarm, I ran out to see what was happening. Oh, no. Let me perform a citizen's arrest. Lisa, what do you got?
Well, Tiffany took mine because I can't stand chewing either. But I don't know, the geese sit on top of the houses and just squawk nonstop.
Yes.
We got raccoons that fight at night, like outside of our window. I swear it's the worst sound ever. So
don't tell Bucky's, they'll go after the raccoon. Mm-hmm. I got a lot. So my first one is the people who make the sound after they drink, you know, that's number one. Number two, you know, I go to the gym. I hate the grunters at the gym. The guys who have to, get it. You're working out. The whole damn world doesn't need to know that you're working out by grunting. Mm-hmm. And then the last one that I would outlaw like today is, you know, I'm always behind the guy in the airplane who has to speak on the speakerphone, who's telling the whole, it's similar to the other guy. Yeah, we get it. You're involved in some sale. We get it. They're always holding their phone like this. You know, the guys who are holding their phone like this, mm-hmm. like get a friggin' AirPod, buddy. AirPod's been around for 30 years, but he's got to hold his phone like this and just talk. And everyone's got to hear how important the guy is before you fly off to Des Moines. Just please stop. Enough.
Top ears aren't going to sell themselves, Rich. You got to close the deal when you got to close the deal.
We get it. Everyone gets it.
Solving the world's problems once again. Good job, everyone. Simon Kishishian and Tina M. Hughes. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks, Illinois State Representative Cam Buckner joined us, Professor Gabe Feldman of Tulane University, David Reedman, founder of the K-12 School Shooting Database, and Samantha Steele with the Cook County Board of Review. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Sagel for Tina Martini, and Rich Linkov. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkov. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.